Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the U.S. return to the JCPOA would be meaningful if the sanctions are lifted. North Korea's leader says the U.S. is the biggest enemy of his country and Washington's policy against Pyongyang will never change. Also ahead, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says lawmakers are preparing to move forward on a motion to impeach Donald Trump if the president does not resign. Good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says anti-Iran sanctions must be immediately removed. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says the sanctions are vicious and a crime against the Iranian nation.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, came down hard on the United States and its allies over their years-long sanctions against the Iranian people. Ayatollah Khamenei has stressed that the measures are based on a baseless animosity and have to be lifted right away. Iran's leader noted that setting conditions for the removal of sanctions is nonsense. He said a possible U.S. return to the 2015 nuclear deal would be meaningless if the sanctions stay in place. Ayatollah Khamenei threw his weight behind the recent move by the Iranian government to scale down its commitments under the deal known as the JCPOA, saying that Tehran will not accept any obligations without reciprocal measures, adding that it would be meaningless for the Islamic Republic to implement all its commitments under the JCPOA when the other side implements almost none of its. Ayatollah Khamenei slammed comments made by some Western countries over Iran's regional policies. He has stressed that Tehran will continue to play its role for regional stability like its recent contribution to Iraq and Syria that led to the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group there. The Iran leader said that it is the U.S. that finds its interest in destabilizing the region, noting that such plots have been explicitly stated by some American thinkers, including someone from the American Enterprise Institute. Speaking on Iran's defense capabilities, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the country is strong enough now to deter a war similar to the one launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein with arms and backing of the West in the 1980s. Iran's leader then touched upon recent developments surrounding the U.S. presidential election, saying the so-called American values and democracy have turned into a laughingstock even among American friends. He said what happened in Washington, D.C. was the very thing Americans were planning to incite in Iran over a decade ago.
Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister takes a jab at European countries for their double standards in condemning what he called the U.S. President Donald Trump's assault on the rule of law.
Those who succumbed to Trump's lawless bullying for 4 years to protect their skin at our people's expense now condemn his assault on the rule of law, but still try to use his economic terrorism against Iran as leverage.
Zarif said European countries should grow a spine to stand up against Trump's lawless conduct against Iran. Tehran has repeatedly called on the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal to fulfill their commitments after Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the agreement in 2018. Iran started to scale back its commitments under the accord when the European signatories failed to meet their end of the deal under U.S. pressure. Iran says the European Union's mere talk of support for the agreement is not enough and that the bloc needs to compensate for the U.S. withdrawal. Political commentator Lawrence Davidson says the U.S. return to the Iran nuclear deal would not be difficult under the Biden administration.
And the more Trump disgraces himself, or his, you can see him in disgrace, the easier it'll be for Biden to rid the country of his policies or change his policies. That certainly is going to be the case domestically, and it might very well carry over into foreign policy So my feeling is that when the Iranian representatives meet with Biden's representatives, shall we say, it's a new ball game. And I don't think that it's going to be particularly difficult to get back to the original agreement if that's what the Iranians want. The Europeans will change their tune as well, because the type of pressure that's going to be on them will change with the Biden administration.
Elsewhere, North Korea's leader says Washington's hostile policies towards Pyongyang would never change regardless of who occupies the White House. Kim Jong-un called the United States the biggest enemy of North Korea and an obstacle to its development. Kim said North Korea's political activities should be focused and redirected at subduing the U.S. policies. He also called for more research and development of advanced military equipment, as well as the expansion of the country's nuclear capabilities. Kim, however, stressed that his country would not misuse its nuclear power. North Korea says its nuclear program is a strong deterrent against U.S. military threats. Talks aimed at denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula have been stalled for months over Washington's refusal to meet Pyongyang's demand for sanctions relief. Jennifer Chang is our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul, and joins us now. Jennifer, welcome. So, North Korean leader basically reiterating a stance of the country that the United States is still the biggest enemy towards Pyongyang, and U.S. policy doesn't change regardless of who the president is there.
That's right. And everyone was waiting for bated breath to see what the North Korean leader was going to say about North Korea's new stance towards Joe Biden, the president-elect, who's going to take office in just a couple of days on January 20th. Right now, the hopes in the U.S. were that the North would be more conciliatory. After all, the U.S. president-elect Biden has said that he is willing to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and try to work out a deal, another nuclear deal. And he has taken quite a conciliatory approach, but the North is adamant that the U.S. must first drop its hostile policy toward North Korea, saying that ever since the Hanoi summit, which was a disaster, the second summit between the U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, in February 2019, ever since then, things have just been going downhill. The U.S. has been getting more and more hostile in its policy. And those summit talks were a failure. The two sides failed to reach a deal, and talks between the U.S. and North Korea on the North's nuclear issue have been deadlocked ever since. And that doesn't appear to be going to be changed soon, because the North is now developing missiles within a 15,000-kilometer range. That means it can hit any part of the U.S. with a nuclear-tipped missile. It also said it wants to miniaturize nuclear warheads, continue doing that until those can re-enter the atmosphere on a missile, with nobody doubting, not a single person doubting in the world that they can do that. Right now, most people think they can do that, but there are still a few skeptics. Well, they want to make sure everybody knows they can do it. And they also have completed the research design of a new nuclear submarine, and that's in its final screening process. That's also a huge threat to the U.S. That means it can shoot nuclear-tipped missiles at the U.S. that don't even have to be ICBMs, because those nuclear submarines can get very close to the U.S. without being detected even. So the North is really a strong player on the world scene in terms of being a nuclear power. It's only one of four nuclear powers: U.S., China, Russia, and North Korea. One of the four superpowers in nuclear terms. Only China, Russia, and North Korea can hit the U.S. with a nuclear-tipped missile. So the North is going to have the upper hand at the bargaining table with the new U.S. President, Joe Biden.
Thanks a lot for that, Jennifer. Jennifer Chang, they are correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul. And moving on, the World Health Organization has urged the rich nations to stop jumping the queue and making bilateral deals for the first wave of COVID-19 vaccines.
Vaccine nationalism hurts us all and is self-defeating. But on the flip side, vaccinating equitably saves lives, stabilizes health systems, and would lead to a truly global economic recovery that stimulates job creation.
The WHO chief said that low and most middle-income nations are not receiving the coronavirus vaccine yet. He noted that 36 out of the 42 countries which have started effective COVID-19 vaccination are high-income nations, and the remaining six are middle-income. There are fears that advanced purchase of coronavirus vaccines by rich nations could make them unaffordable and inaccessible to the majority of countries. Elsewhere, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has called on President Donald Trump to resign or face impeachment. Pelosi said she has instructed the House Rules Committee to move forward with a motion for impeachment if Trump does not leave office voluntarily. Pelosi said in a statement after a three-hour meeting with House Democrats that the lawmakers will preserve every option, including Amendment 25, which deals with presidential succession and disability. The Democratic representatives have reportedly prepared a draft article of impeachment against Trump. U.S. media say the draft accuses Trump of engaging in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting insurrection. Meanwhile, the U.S. president-elect has called Trump one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States.
I've been saying for now well over a year, he is not fit to serve. He is not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America. And so the idea that I think he shouldn't be out of office.
Joe Biden said people who stormed the Capitol should be prosecuted. Biden also urged that the breakdown of security at the Capitol grounds should be investigated. He stressed that he has confidence in the country's Secret Service to make sure his presidential inauguration goes off safely. On Wednesday, Trump supporters stormed the Congress building in a bid to overturn his election defeat. Meanwhile, a new opinion poll that is, says more than half of Americans want President Donald Trump to be immediately removed from office over the deadly unrest on Capitol Hill. According to the Reuters Ipsos poll, 7 out of 10 of those who voted for Trump in November opposed the storming of the Capitol grounds. Nearly 70% of Americans surveyed also said that they disapprove of Trump's actions in the run-up to the assault. 5 people were killed when Trump's supporters overran the U.S. Congress on Wednesday. And Twitter has permanently suspended U.S. President Donald Trump's account, citing the risk of further incitement of violence. Twitter said the decision was made after a close review of recent tweets on Trump's account and the context around them. It said 2 of the president's tweets violated the company's policy against glorification of violence. Twitter had initially blocked Trump's account temporarily following the siege of Capitol Hill by his supporters on Wednesday. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says the recent chaos on the U.S. Capitol has revealed President Donald Trump's true criminal identity to the world. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said what Americans saw on Wednesday was the consequence of Trump's dangerous policies which many have warned about. He added that Americans used to see these scenes in other countries, but now they are experiencing them by themselves. The Hezbollah chief noted that the raid on the U.S. Congress shows the true identity of American democracy that Washington has been trying to export to other countries. Nasrallah said the event was only a small sample of what the U.S. was doing in two other countries in the past, like Lebanon, Iraq, and others. The executive director of American Human Rights Council says the attack on the U.S. Congress by Trump supporters show how he has divided the country across political lines.
Many of these people who participated in these riots, they are not necessarily racist and fascist. Many of them are, yes, but many are driven by high emotions, and unfortunately, it was incited by the rotten rhetoric that President Trump kept using that gives some energy to these people to act in this improper, uncalled fashion against the symbol of democracy in America. The American nation is sharply divided. Nobody can underestimate or undermine the importance of numbers in America. So when we talk that 75 million people, 75 million Americans voted for President Trump, that's not an easy number to ignore. People always looked at America and the model of democracy in America as something perfect, as something ideal, as something that cannot be touched. Unfortunately, what we witnessed showed otherwise, that yes, this could happen in America the same way that it can happen in any other part of the world.
Another achievement for Iran in medical fields, a science-based company has developed a soft surgery method to cure optical disorders without scars and outside the surgery room. Haman Abadi tells us more.
Iranian experts and ophthalmologists have gathered in Tehran to unveil a new method in eye surgery which enables the doctors to cure problems in their offices without anesthesia and bleeding. Paniz Plexer offers an alternative to invasive surgical procedures, reducing recovery time and any complications that can arise before and after surgery. It is an innovative development in eye treatments by utilizing the fourth state of matter, or plasma.
This new technique that uses plasma is being practiced for the first time. Within the past 20 years, plasma has been used in dentistry, treatment of cancer, and scar healing. Since some years ago, we decided to use it in ophthalmology to make sure it is safe. Almost 15 eye diseases can be cured at the doctor's office without going to the surgery room.
This is an international event to unveil a low-cost method for eye disorder treatments. It is a pain-free Iranian method called PANIS, or plasma-assisted non-invasive surgery. This is a result of 5 years of collaboration between two Iranian companies and an Italian counterpart.
This method has been practiced in many countries, but Iranian scientists have now turned it to a method to decrease treatment costs, as it does not need surgery rooms and hospital beds. Such outstanding achievements show that the sanctions by the West have not been able to slow down Iran's advancement, proving that the Islamic Republic is moving forward on the right track. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
That report brings an end to our bulletin for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
European distrust of American motives was behind the EU leaders' recent signing of a comprehensive agreement on investment with China over the urgent objections of the Donald Trump administration and Joe Biden's transition team. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Asia Times website. This article is published under the heading two-faced U.S. trade policy erodes Atlantic alliance. Stay tuned for the details, please. European distrust of American motives was behind the EU leaders' recent signing of a comprehensive agreement on investment with China over the urgent objections of the Donald Trump administration and Joe Biden's transition team. Washington's restrictions on trade and investment with China, Europeans believe, provide pretext for dodgy deals that favor U.S. companies at the expense of competitors on the other side of the Atlantic. The Trump administration, of course, has long been in a trade war with Beijing, and there have been numerous news reports that Biden's advisors had let European officials know they hoped for a delay that would give the new administration time to chime in before finalization of the pact. Matt Pottinger, deputy national security advisor to Trump, issued a statement saying, "Leaders in both U.S. political parties and across the U.S. government are perplexed and stunned that the EU is moving towards a new investment treaty right on the eve of a new U.S. administration. Europe has ignored the pressure because Washington isn't fighting a war, but rather is talking war while American companies work out their side deals with China." One cause of European rancor, the Financial Times reported on December 24th, is that U.S. authorities grant exceptions to American companies trading with China while denying them to Europeans. European tech executives and diplomats are accusing the U.S. of using its sanctions regime to shut them out of the Chinese market while offering exemptions for American companies, the newspaper reported. Over the past 2 years, the U.S. has imposed aggressive sanctions on Chinese companies such as Huawei and, as of Friday, the chipmaker SMIC, which have prevented them from buying most U.S.-made technologies. The Financial Times quoted an unnamed European senior executive as saying the sanctions had created an America-first trade policy. So far, U.S. companies have been given licenses to supply Huawei, while European suppliers cannot. Many European businesses that produce chips and chip-making equipment are affected by American sanctions because they rely on U.S. intellectual property. A second European tech executive complained of having once been stopped from supplying components to Chinese buyers because of suspicions that they could be used for military purposes, but the market for the components was quickly filled by U.S. vendors selling through middlemen. Trade restrictions always provide opportunities for special treatment of politically connected, regardless of which party is in power, as the Wall Street Journal observed in a December 28 editorial. As Mr. Trump's tariffs began to bite, Congress sent hundreds of letters to the U.S. Special Trade Representative supporting specific tariff exclusions. Despite U.S. sanctions, there is no shortage of computer chips in China, which expects to install 10 million 5G base stations by 2024. Huawei has limited access to the top-of-the-line chips that power high-end smartphones, with transistor gate width of 7 nanometers or less, but it doesn't need them for its mobile broadband infrastructure. The U.S. sanctions have nuisance value for Huawei, but haven't stopped the Chinese broadband juggernaut. Sales of American chip design and testing software to Chinese customers boomed during 2020. As there are reports in December 24th analysis, the tech war that isn't. Cadence, one of the top three American firms, doubled its Chinese sales during the third quarter. Although the Commerce Department banned sales to Huawei's high silicon chip design subsidiary, Chinese startups, staffed by former top engineers for the American design firms, and in some cases funded by the American firms, have hired Huawei engineers to produce the same designs under a different corporate logo. China is the world's biggest market for chip design, and American firms can't maintain their lead without selling to China. No American firm manufactures telecom infrastructure. The Trump administration declined to mobilize American resources to create a competitor to Huawei, and also refused to put money behind the number two telecom equipment maker, Sweden's Ericsson. The Trump administration wasn't offering any such incentives, a fatal mistake, given the cold shoulder by Cisco. Kudlow then started listening to the software industry, which claimed that fancy coding could turn generic computer components into an alternative to Huawei. He enthused to Wall Street Journal, Dell and Microsoft are now moving very rapidly to develop software and code capabilities that will in fact replace a lot of the equipment. To quote Michael Dell, software is eating the hardware in 5G. To a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and to software companies, the solution to every problem looks like a million lines of code, especially if the federal government provides $1 billion subsidy. That is what the Software Industry Coalition, the Open Radio Access Network, is demanding from the federal government. It's one of the worst ideas to pass muster in American industry since New Coke, as Crissell explained. No one knows if it will work. Software might substitute for the sophisticated custom chips that filter out the signal from the noise in ultra-high-speed 5G transmissions, but they might not. It will take about 5 years to find out, according to industry experts, and the debugging and testing of billions of lines of code probably would take another 2 years. Network security has been the Trump administration's stated concern about Huawei 5G networks, but an open access system with thousands of access points offers countless opportunities for malign actors. Worst of all, the software solution only handles the routing of information once it is transmitted from a base station to a central network. The 5G applications for the Internet of Things, including autonomous vehicles and self-programming industrial robots, require greater computing power in the base station itself to allow the 5G network to communicate with client machines. There are a couple of small-scale test projects for O-RAN approach in Europe, but European telecom experts view the software-based solution as another feckless American welfare program for the world's richest tech companies. That's why Europe in November put forward its own declaration of independence from American semiconductor technology. In early December, the EU agreed on a European initiative on processors and semiconductor technologies, committing about $30 billion of the European Recovery and Resilience Facility funds to digital sovereignty. As Thierry Breton, the EU Commissioner for Internal Market, put it, Europe has all it takes to diversify and reduce critical dependencies. A collective approach can help leverage existing strengths and embrace new opportunities as advanced processor chips play an ever more important role for Europe's industrial strategy and digital sovereignty. That, of course, means reducing dependence on U.S. intellectual property. China is, of course, paying close attention. A European diplomat based in China told the Financial Times, this declaration shows that European governments want to be less dependent on U.S. technology, although that will take a long time. This process was accelerated by the U.S. sanctions. For European companies, China is such a big market that they need to find ways of serving it. That remark was cited in a report on the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment on December 31st on the Chinese political website, guancha.cn.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and how about listening to a general advice from the model of magnanimity, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. When you gain power over your adversary, pardon him by way of thanks for being able to overpower him.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
اگه انسان بیفته دنبال این مسائل، دنبال فزون طلبی، هیچی قانع نمیشه. همینطوری
Human beings are not easily satisfied in terms of material things, and extravagance has no end. This type of life puts pressure on both the people and society. All classes of a society, from a shopkeeper to a clergyman, must know that extravagance and overexpenditure will damage our lives, especially when we want to help others. If divinity and remembrance of Allah does not exist in our life, then we might face some problems. For instance, I, as a clergyman, cannot explain the religious matters exactly to the people. Or I take the position of the people who are more qualified than me. All these deviations and miserliness are all rooted in forgetting the remembrance of Allah. The emphasis on remembrance of Allah in the Quran is because the righteousness of people does exist in this action. If we remember Allah frequently, we can do our obligations in the best way possible, leave our unlawful actions, and help the people around us. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khala Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Khala Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Saudi Arabia is trying to resume relations with its neighbor Qatar after more than 3 years of tension. In early December 2020, Riyadh announced that a resolution is within reach with this tiny yet gas-rich country. But there are a number of questions that need to be addressed. What has made the Saudi kingdom review its policy on Doha at this point in time? Is Riyadh really seeking a long-standing friendship with Qatar? And is the resolution really within reach? And what challenges might await the Saudis? While many are hailing the Saudis' initiative as a huge breakthrough, others think there is a long way to go. Since June 2017, Qatar has been under a crippling blockade from Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt. But now, not the whole anti-Qatar quartet, but only Saudi Arabia is trying to reach out to Doha.
The world is changing dramatically. The 2020 has been an amazing year. At one point, I recall the price of oil was actually, they would pay you a certain amount to take a barrel of oil. It actually went below zero, if you like. So the whole order of things is dramatically reshaped, pretty much to the disadvantage of Saudi Arabia.
In its dying days, the Trump administration is busy keeping all its allies in the Persian Gulf united against Iran. Outgoing U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Trump's Middle East advisor Jared Kushner have both visited the region for this purpose. But the Saudis have their own reasons for détente. The kingdom's traditional status in the Arab world has been damaged after its undeniable role in normalizing ties between some Arab states and the Israeli regime. There are even opposing views inside the kingdom towards normalization with Israel, revealing fault lines among different political clans.
The concept that we're seeing some kind of quote-unquote normalization in the Middle East, as it seems that Trump's term is coming to an end, and Trump does seem to be playing a big role in this, I think that is a misrepresentation. The Abraham Accords suggest to me that the real agenda is to establish a more solid military alliance between the Gulf powers, the monarchies in the Gulf region, the Arab monarchies, and Israel. And this is not has nothing to do with normalization. It's actually a war agenda that is being advertised in the public relations language of normalization.
Moreover, Riyadh is not going to enjoy its greatest supporter, namely the Trump administration, in the 4 years to come. And at the same time, it has now received desirable signals from the Biden administration. This shaky position has made the Saudi officials take more cautious policies in the region. By modifying its foreign policy goals, the kingdom is in fact bracing itself for the approaching change of administration in Washington and a possible new order in the region. Moreover, a rapprochement with Doha means the Saudis can concentrate more on the Yemen war, which has turned out to be a quagmire for the Saudi army.
And I think Saudi Arabia, you know, has to maneuver to not become a kind of pariah in the world. Its attacks and assaults on Yemen and the Houthi militias in Yemen have been, you know, negatively viewed in the international community, and properly so. Saudi Arabia has, could I say, a big PR problem that it has to address.
That said, little progress has been made so far on resolving the dispute, as the trade and travel embargo in Qatar has not been lifted yet. Meanwhile, Qatar Airways, the country's flagship carrier, has been suing Saudi Arabia and other blockading partners in the Persian Gulf over the closure of their airspaces to the Doha-based airline. The airline is reportedly seeking at least $5 billion from the States for compensation related to the closure. In fact, there are plenty of sticking points for the Saudis. The most serious challenge they are faced with is how to get the other blockading states on board. Among silence from the Emiratis, who are by many accounts the main instigator behind the blockade, a satisfactory solution seems elusive. After about 4 years, cracks are becoming visible in the anti-Qatar alliance, while Riyadh wanting to end the blockade, while the UAE insists on it remaining in place. Much to the Saudis' dismay, Bahrain and Egypt are also reportedly inclined to Abu Dhabi in this case. According to Medhat Rende, a former Turkish ambassador to Qatar, the Emiratis don't even mind competing with Saudi Arabia, showing their willingness to overtake the kingdom.
This is something of a mystery to me. But UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain, they must have points in common that cause them to see Qatar in a different light. Perhaps they're not party to or privy to the internal dynamics of what's going on in Saudi Arabia that is pulling Saudi Arabia in this direction. Could it be that there is actually some chance of a kind of reconciliation of Iran and Saudi Arabia through Qatar as an intermediary? Perhaps this is an agenda that UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain aren't in a position to cope with right now.
While some confidence-building steps might be taken in the run-up to the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council summit, it seems that the source of tension is still in place. At the core of the crisis are Qatar's ties with Iran, its alleged support for the Muslim Brotherhood, and its alleged use of the state-owned news network Al Jazeera to spread the Brotherhood's message, inciting popular uprisings. The Qataris have sent no signals that they are going to give in to these demands, which are among Saudi Arabia's 13 demands over the blockade.
Saudi Arabia has a cause to seek friendlier relations with Qatar. They speak about this through the language of normalcy, bringing back normalcy, but nothing is really normal about the situation we're dealing with these days.
Perhaps Qatar's biggest enemy than the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is the UAE Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, who is deeply mistrustful of Doha. In the words of Kristen Coates Ulrichsen, a fellow for the Middle East at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy, "I don't at the moment see that the UAE is on board, as it might be a difficult sell for the Saudis to persuade the UAE to sign up to a final agreement or even a preliminary one." All in all, even if this current standoff is resolved, given the number of issues likely to remain unresolved, there is high potential for future conflict, and perhaps another crisis in the future.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection has used a controversial Centers for Disease Control and Prevention order authorizing the expulsion of asylum seekers on supposed public health grounds to send multiple U.S.-born infants who are by law U.S. citizens and their migrant families across the southern border to Mexico. Three mothers said they weren't told they were being sent to Mexico and didn't immediately receive proof of citizenship for their infants. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Felipe Dolejos, writer. This article is published under the heading, Citing the Pandemic, CBP has expelled newborn U.S. citizens with their migrant mothers. Here's the details. U.S. Customs and Border Protection has used a controversial Centers for Disease Control and Prevention order authorizing the expulsion of asylum seekers on supposed public health grounds to send multiple U.S.-born infants who are by law U.S. citizens and their migrant families across the southern border to Mexico. In interviews with The Intercept, three asylum-seeking mothers who crossed the border while pregnant describe giving birth in U.S. hospitals, only to be swiftly sent back under false pretenses and without an evaluation of their particular humanitarian circumstances or claims of danger. The Intercept has reviewed medical and immunization records for the women and their infants, which prove U.S. hospital birth and is referring to mothers by pseudonyms due to their precarious status as asylum seekers and the danger they believe they still face in Mexico, where all three remain. None immediately received citizenship paperwork for their infants, and they are unsure if and when they will be allowed to tender an asylum claim. The law does not allow for rapid expulsion of U.S. citizens, said Nicole Ramos, director of the Border Rights Project at Al Otro Lado, a legal and social services organization that is investigating the expulsions. Al Otro Lado, which has a presence in San Diego, Los Angeles, and Tijuana, Mexico, said it is aware of a total of 8 mothers in this situation, 2 of whom it's lost contact and the rest of whom remain in Mexico. One such mother, Loop, was the subject of a complaint filed with the Department of Homeland Security this summer. At the time, CBP claimed that she had departed voluntarily with her toddler and chalked the situation up to a fluke. In an interview with The Intercept, Loop said not only had she not been asked about the expulsion or given affirmative consent for her citizen child to be expelled alongside her, but also she wasn't even aware that she was being turned back to Mexico until she saw the Mexican border agents waiting for her. Joanna, an asylum seeker fleeing gang threats in Honduras, said she arrived at the border 9 months pregnant and with her 8-year-old son in July. She was already experiencing labor pains and decided to cross the border to seek help. Border Patrol officers called an ambulance and took her son to the processing center known as La Parrera or The Kennel. She was moved to Scripps Mercy Hospital, Chula Vista in Chula Vista, California, and gave birth to an infant son the next morning. According to Joanna, CBP personnel assured both her and a social worker who had been assigned to her case that she and her sons would be able to stay in the United States to await an immigration processing. Instead, they were loaded into a vehicle and only realized that they were being taken to Mexico as they were brought to the port of entry. The hospital declined to make social worker available for comment and said it does not track how many new mothers in immigration custody it treats. Per an agreement with Mexico, the CDC order is meant to apply only to citizens of Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Yet, The Intercept spoke with a mother from Haiti who was sent back to Tijuana 2 days after delivering a baby daughter under CBP custody after attempting to petition for asylum at a port of entry in mid-July. The expulsion policy was first issued in March, ostensibly as a countermeasure to the coronavirus pandemic. It's based on a statute that deals with public health, not immigration, and gives the CDC director the power to prohibit, in whole or in part, the introduction of persons and property from such countries or places as he shall designate in order to prevent the introduction of such a disease. The Wall Street Journal reported in October that senior officials at the CDC thought the measure was unnecessary but implemented it under political pressure from White House advisor Stephen Miller. Its legal premise was questioned in a recent federal court decision that prevented the administration from continuing to expel unaccompanied minors. Nonetheless, the order was reissued in mid-October for an indefinite period of time at the CDC director's discretion and remains active. It generally calls for people who are not U.S. citizens or residents and do not otherwise have entry paperwork to be expelled from the country as quickly as possible, without even the opportunity to file a case for humanitarian protections. Between mid-March and mid-October, over 204,000 expulsions took place, with only a tiny fraction of people exempted under humanitarian categories. Migrants are either sent across the border to Mexico or on flights to their countries of origin, including minors with their families and unaccompanied minors prior to the federal injunction. The CDC order specifically exempts U.S. citizens, and no part of U.S. immigration law appears to authorize the expulsion of people who were born in the United States. CBP spokesperson Matthew Diamond declined to discuss particular cases and said the agency does not keep data on the total number of mothers and newborn U.S. citizen infants expelled under the order. He echoed a previous claim by immigration authorities that migrant mothers who are expelled from the U.S. voluntarily